Hello and welcome to Spin Unspun, the podcast about leaders and leadership in the world of corporate affairs and corporate communications. I'm Damien Rees from Instinctive Partners, in conversation with the best and the brightest in corporate affairs, asking all the questions and discussing all the topics that really matter to people who shoulder the weighty responsibility for corporate reputation and effective communications. Today, I'm delighted to be joined in the Instinctive studio by Jennifer Scardino, Head of Corporate Communications for Visa Europe. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast. Thanks very much for your time.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And also joining me today is my Instinctive co-host, Libby Wallace, Senior Account Manager at Instinctive. Libby, welcome. Nice to see you. Now, normally, this is where I ask our guests to summarize their career progress. But this time, I'm going to do something different. And I'm just going to quote from your CV, if I may, because I think that's the best way for us to frame the rest of our conversation today. You graduated from Columbia University with a political science degree. You then cut your teeth at City Hall in New York, serving as the assistant press secretary to the mayor for 4 years. In 1993, you moved to Washington, D.C., and you joined the Clinton administration as head of public affairs and chief of staff at the Securities and Exchange Commission, where Arthur Levitt was the chairman. You did that for 2 terms. And then you relocated to London to spearhead corporate affairs and marketing for Citigroup, which is obviously one of the world's largest banks. And you were there for 10 years. And I think also you evolved your role there, which I think will be interesting for a lot of the listeners. And you served as chief of staff to the head of global investment bank, and you also co-headed the economic and political strategies group. And then you moved to Santander UK. And as many people will know, this is a bank that consolidated much of the banking high street in the UK, buying up Abbey National, Alliance and Leicester, Bradford and Bingley. You managed corporate affairs and marketing there, as well as public affairs and CSR. And you did that for 4 years. And then you moved to Madrid with your boss, Ana Botan, who herself had been appointed global executive chairman, and you served as the global group chief communications officer for nearly 5 years. And if that wasn't enough, you're now head of corporate communications at Visa Europe, the world's sixth most valued brand.
It is.
I believe. I'm exhausted just reading the script, I have to say.
You read it very well. I'm humbled.
Let's start by just winding back to the beginning, because this is something I'm really interested in. City Hall, assistant press secretary to the mayor of New York for 4 years. What was that like? And how has it been relevant to you in your career going forward?
It was not a grand plan. As you said, I went to Columbia. And what you did if you graduated from Columbia in decent standing was you went to Wall Street. And that's what a lot of my friends and colleagues did. The universe works in funny ways because I end up in Wall Street, 20 years later. But it was not of interest to me at the time. I really wanted to pursue a law degree or journalism. But I was locally active in politics during university and had some friends who worked for the mayor and asked me to come in. I did not join as an assistant press secretary. I joined as a research assistant in the press office. I was later promoted to assistant press secretary, but it was an incredible experience. And I think the best way to kind of really learn about good communications. My children laugh at me when I tell these stories because I think they envision the story I'm about to tell you in like black and white because it feels so long ago. We didn't even have mobile phones, let alone online news sources. There was a ticker tape in the press office. It was like a big newsroom. There was a wall of televisions on one side, a wall of radios on the other. And you did it the old-fashioned way. You monitored the news by standing up against the wall if you were expecting a story, or turning off half of the screens to listen to another one, or standing at the radio booth. Literally reading off a ticker tape. So it was very different. The phones were going mad. It was very heady experience to a very young, very inexperienced person who just loved politics. And a couple of the experiences specifically, which I think I will forever be grateful for, though at the time maybe they weren't quite as fun. I had the task in the early days of my career there of producing the daily news clips, which meant at the time going to the newsstand at about 5 a.m., buying two or three copies of each paper, because we would then sit there and go through them with an X-Acto knife and sellotape. Messy job. You'd be covered in newsprint and gooey from glue sticks, and you'd produce the day's clips that had to be on the mayor's desk at 7, and you had to create this news clip pack in thematic order and with headers to make it easier for him if he was looking for something on an issue or a politician or a problem, and prioritize them in what you thought was the best order of importance. Since he didn't have much time, he would go through them very quickly and then stand there at, you know, a Xerox machine and make copies for all of his cabinet members. But what a way to learn news judgment. What a way to see how stories play out and how people respond and what goes well and what ends up on the front page. I mean, I think, looking back on it, that I have a good nose for news, but probably not naturally. So that was incredible. Then we also did things as I became an assistant to the press secretary. We advanced a lot of the political events. So that means you go ahead of the mayor or the candidate, depending on the state of the election cycle. You find the photo ops. You find the third-party advocates who are at an event who might be good to encourage to get in front of a camera or speak with a reporter to help amplify your story. So you learn campaigning.
Yes.
Which is probably slightly underrated in corporate comms today. Yeah. We're doing more of it in the last 10 years, but we didn't do a lot of it previously. Yeah. So that was incredible. And then you just learn a bunch of fun things that you never forget. And the one of my favorites is there was a local politician who is now a very prominent national politician in the U.S., so I won't say his name, but he was a New York City local politician, and he used to get to these events, and he'd watch us line up the photo op, and he'd hold back. And I watched it a few times and think, what is he doing? And then he'd join kind of late, right before the cameras start snapping, right? And so you'd have a bank of TV cameras and, I don't know, 15 or 20 still photographers, and he'd kind of wedge himself in there. And I realized after watching this for weeks, he knew exactly where to stand to get his name first in the photo caption.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you just learn and pick up on these things that nobody ever taught us. Comms, I know, is now a something you can have a proper education in.
Yes.
But it was nothing anyone ever taught us about. You learned because you were doing it.
Right.
So little things like that just give you insights and seeing the way people work and think and how to tell a story. A remarkable experience.
But having that campaign head, though, is quite interesting, isn't it? Because you mentioned it's an underrated skill in corporate affairs, corporate comms. Maybe it's coming back, but that mentality of campaigning sounds like it's something that it stayed with you during your career.
A politician is always campaigning, right? You are always trying to get that balance of defensive comms and proactive comms. And so I think if that's the only thing you know, which a lot of people who have political kind of beginnings in comms, they do keep that. And I think it serves companies very well.
And so thinking about that, having worked in politics and in business, how do they mix? How does a business effectively engage with politics and communicate about political issues?
It's a really interesting and thornier issue today than I think it probably has been in my career. When I started, we worked really hard in corporate situations to stay out of politics. I mean, we were studious about it. Very engaged in policy, right? Policy is very different than politics. But we didn't touch it. And it was kind of considered a bit of a third rail. And if you had really good teams that did intergovernmental relations, they navigated it very well. But for the most part, the rest of us held them back. Business over the last few years started pre-COVID, but really happened mostly over COVID, is now the most trusted institution in civil society. And that brings with it, some people think, a duty to use an established platform and a credible voice to opine on a lot of things that we would deem political or maybe social. And I personally think it's a pretty dangerous thing. There are people who do it well. Jamie Dimon does it well. There are executives and others who, you know, have literally lost jobs. One recently who commented on some of the conflict in the Gaza Strip. So I think you have to be careful. And I guess my advice to anybody who was thinking about it would be, on policy, yes, you have a fiduciary duty to your shareholders and the purpose of your business for your teams and your employees. On policy, you engage as much as possible. But on politics, I think you have to use enormous care. Companies are not elected. They're not representative of really anybody, maybe their employees, right? So I say stick pretty close to your knitting, by which I mean if something is commercially relevant, it's in your business space, you have some expertise, that makes perfect sense. If it is an issue for your employees or your customers, again, I think that's a good place to be. But I'd think hard about the audiences. If there is an issue that is worrying your employees, find a way to communicate to your employees. You don't need to put out a press release. If there is a specific issue that is threatening to your customers or clients in some way, communicate with them about it. I think I'd be very careful about using the platform carelessly. And I think when you do, you have to really hold your nerve. As I said, I think Jamie Dimon does this pretty well. It is very, you know, when Jamie opines about something, he really, and he does not avoid controversial issues, but he has the courage of his conviction. He's prepared to argue it through. I am sure he is mostly, not probably entirely, as a comms person would hope, prepared and you know, for what he is doing and what he might face. But I think it's a really fascinating and complicated issue that we're all going to face more and more, because in the year ahead, as you probably know, I think there are more than 40 national elections in major democracies in 2024. Policies are going to change. Relationships are going to change. And businesses need to be part of that dialogue, but I'm not sure you need to always have that dialogue publicly.
Yeah. And you mentioned Jamie Dimon, and he's always struck me as the sort of person who, if he does opine, he's thought through the implications of what I am saying. I don't want to paint myself into a corner here by saying X, because in 1 year's time, in whatever, X may have changed and I'm in trouble. And I think that's another big risk, isn't it? When you're talking about political issues, you end up thinking you're saying something good at the time, but experience tells us things can change really quickly and you will regret saying a lot of stuff. So you really do have to think things through very carefully. And an allied question to that, to the one Libby asked, other than politics, I think businesses are being asked to be moral judges, are they not? And show moral leadership. Black Lives Matter is a good example. And a lot of clients I've worked with, especially the comms teams internally, do feel suddenly under a lot of pressure from external audiences. Sometimes it's influencers who they may rely on for commercial relationships, or some of their customer base. They feel under pressure that they need to say something. We must say something about this. People are saying, oh, we've got to do something about it. But to your point, holding your nerve is quite important at that moment, I think, isn't it?
I think it really is. And I think you also have to be prepared that if you start commenting, you're building an expectation that you will continue. And as I said before, that there are going to be certain things that are highly relevant to your audiences. But where does it stop? You know, I mean, companies were under a lot of pressure to opine about Roe v. Wade. There is, I wouldn't call it pressure, but there is an expectation that we will comment on some of the conflicts around the world right now. And I think you have to, as you said, that Jamie Dimon, I'm sure, does, you have to really think the implications of that through. A lot of times you have to do that as a comms professional very quickly, because the question might come out of nowhere. Somebody told me recently that they had a question. They were nothing to do with the drinks industry in any way, but had a question about the Bud Light conflict and a question about, oh, it seems maybe you're a little lower profile on Pride this year. Like, is that because of Bud Light? And, you know, this executive wasn't prepared to say anything to that question. So it is a challenge for us. I think we're, as comms professionals, generally well prepared, and we, if you're doing your job well, you're talking enough to enough people and enough journalists to be able to anticipate some of those moments.
But
it's a fascinating trend, as I say, and I think it will just continue into the year ahead.
Yeah.
Santander has become an incredibly well-known UK brand, and I say this as a Santander customer, but it was built out of acquisitions. And I'm really interested to know if that poses a specific communications and reputation issue for a business.
It certainly did. It certainly did for Santander in the UK. And in fact, as Damien said, I also joined Citigroup, which was newly formed and was going through a transformation, because Citi in Europe was Citibank, Travelers, which the brands you would know are Salomon Brothers and Smith Barney. And of course, in Europe, we Citi had acquired Schroders. So we were taking two massive organizations that were culturally very different in good ways, and Schroders, which was a different thing again, much more of a merchant bank. And so just like at Santander, you know, I think comms teams can really come into their own in these transformations. There was a big integration issue at both of these organizations, but it manifested itself in Santander UK as some pretty difficult customer service issues. And I'm sure Damien will remember this pretty well. For a couple of years running, Santander was winning what was called by the Daily Mail the Wooden Spoon Award, which was, you know, the kind of, I think it was actually, Damien might remember better than me, I think it was probably a readership poll, vote for the worst customer service. Yeah. It was not a made up, it was troublesome.
It wasn't good anyway.
It wasn't good, but I will say it certainly focused the minds. And Anna Botin had just come into Santander UK. I mean, she was the one who hired me when Antonio Horta Osorio, who had been the chief executive, moved over to Lloyd's with Matt Young, his fabulous comms director. And that was a commercial issue and a reputational issue. And so everybody got behind it. And the comms team designed what was intended to be an internal communications program to try to support the shift that we needed to go through to ultimately improve service for customers. That was really obviously the goal. But that internal comms campaign, which we called Simple, Personal, and Fair, was, you know, about the way that you treat your colleagues and your staff and your customers and your stakeholders and your owners and all your stakeholders. It became the tagline for the bank ultimately, and became the kind of galvanizing message for our comms for many years. And I am very proud to say, all credit to Anna Botin and her team, that Santander ended up very close to the top of the league tables in customer service.
So Simple, Personal, Fair started out as an internal comms campaign.
So we went around the country and we talked in depth with our legacy brand personnel and our branches. We interviewed customers, and the pain points in our service were really consistent for everybody. It was overly complicated, so we said simple. It was felt to a lot of people that they were treated like accounts and not like human beings who had challenges and problems and opportunities that needed more support. And that, you know, we had to have a level playing field for everybody and treat everybody with respect and be fair not only to the customer, but to our own internal teams, to our shareholders, to our parent company. And that was fair. So it came together like that. The reason, Damien, it really got there is because it worked.
Right.
People remembered it. Internally, we saw people making posters for the branches. We saw people sticking, you know, sticky notes on their monitors. Mm. And we thought, we actually may be onto something here. And the marketing team, which I oversaw in addition to comms at Santander UK, said, there really is something here. Let's play around with this. And they did. And it worked with customers too. They understood what it meant. They could remember it. They could quote it back to someone if they didn't feel that we were abiding it. So you can imagine in branches, we had people with buttons and we had, you know, it was really exciting. And it got people, raised the morale, and we simplified products massively. And I mean, comms didn't help that much on that. But I mean, it focused everybody's thoughts and purpose. And you'd wake up in the morning and think about, how am I living simple, personal, and fair? So I'm very proud of it.
And so going from working with Anna Botan in the UK to working with her as she ran Santander globally from Spain, that must have been an enormous change, was it not? I mean, what was that experience like for you? Scary or not?
It was intense. It was an intense period, but incredibly enjoyable and rewarding. I had the benefit, I have to disclose, of growing up in Southern California, where I was educated bilingually. So I was a Spanish speaker. My Spanish was more Latin American than Castilian. That made it a lot easier. It would have been really hard. Most Santander executives spoke very good English. But, you know, a lot of things happen in your home market language. And so that was an advantage. Anna, just as she did when she went to Santander UK, had a very strong idea of what she wanted to do, what she thought the opportunities were, what she thought the goals were. You know, I mean, she's a laser-focused executive. She's just absolutely remarkable woman. Mm. And so she had a pretty clear roadmap of where we were going. One of the keys to that, and one of the reasons that I think she asked me to join her, was Santander is a truly global bank, but it wasn't really known as a global bank. It was the biggest bank in the Eurozone, but actually its biggest businesses were in the UK and Brazil and Mexico. And she was really keen to grow the franchise in the US, which is a tricky place to grow a business, specifically a bank, a retail bank. And you know, she had a vision, and it was a demanding one to execute, but it was clear. There was never any doubt what we were doing there and what we were trying to accomplish. So, Amy, it's a blessing to have a boss with such a clear idea, and a blessing to have a boss like Anna Botin, who honestly is probably the executive I've worked for with the most appreciation for the function.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. She absolutely gets it. She brings comms in early and often, and she insists that the people around her do the same.
Yeah.
So you really have a seat at the table, and it makes the job not only more fun, but it makes it more rewarding. You can do better work.
Andrew Walton, your opposite number at Lloyds, who was sitting in that exact chair not so long ago, said the secret of success in corporate affairs is not to pick the job, but pick the boss. And you know, you've got to make sure you're working with somebody who, as you say, really gets corporate affairs, or at least values it, and wants you to do well.
For sure. I mean, Andrew Wise, as always, I couldn't agree more. I think you have to be comfortable with the brand or the company or the industry, but you know, that relationship with the executive is one of the most important things. I also think, I suspect Andrew would agree, that you also want to pick the people around you, right? Mm. I mean, you know, you want to work with people who are better and smarter than you are, and you want to have, you know, you want to work in a culture that is demanding but supportive. For sure, choosing your boss, if you have the luxury to do that, is very good advice.
So given the breadth of experience you've had over the years at all these various different institutions, give us a flavor of some of the most difficult challenges you've faced and your approach to dealing with them.
I imagine you've heard this from some of my peers who've been here before me, in specifically from banks, but 2008 financial crisis was a bear. I was at Citi at the time. Citi had one of the largest U.S. government bailouts at the time under the TARP program. It was ultimately profitable to the taxpayer. I think the return on that was something like $12 billion. But it cost us reputationally, specifically in trust, which is really the existential requirement of working in that business. So those were difficult days. I worked for Wynne Bischoff at the time, and he took over a global job. We had some CEO transitions, so he moved into a global job, and so I supported him through a lot of that. That was a huge challenge, and you know, I think now, however many years later we are, a lot of really good executives and good communicators have pulled through that. But any of us who lived through it, you know, there were dark days. In the late 2010s, I was at Santander at the time. There was a sovereign debt crisis in Europe. You will recall, I'm sure you were still.
Yeah, I was still at the Telegraph.
And that was an equally stressful for a European bank. Santander was in rude health through it, but it was a systemic challenge. It was politically complicated. It was a test of some of the new EU rules and regulations on how that would be dealt with. So that was also difficult. It had commercial implications. It's resulted in some of the highest unemployment rates in some of our main markets. So again, very tricky. Restoring trust was all about restoring trust, just as it was in 2008, and probably came back a little quicker than the global financial crisis. I think one of the really interesting and maybe unique things that happens in comms is a lot of your very best work is absolutely invisible, right? And if you've got a great CEO and a great team and a great leadership committee and, you know, all the other things that we operate, you know, in the environment that we operate with, they'll know it. And they'll know it to their bones, and you will be rewarded for it. You may not get an award on a stage, which, by the way, is also very nice. But a lot of the things, I think, by definition, that I consider my biggest successes, I can't talk about. No. And every comms director has those stories, too.
What's the strategic objective, comms and corporate affairs at Visa Europe, and what are you hoping to achieve there?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Visa, because I sometimes say I'm new. I'm only 2 years in, and I'm still learning. It's actually quite a complex business, but I often say that I think Visa might be the best known, least understood company in the world, and it is because, in large part, the brand is ubiquitous. As Damien said before, sixth most valuable brand in the world, is an incredible asset. But we've done a lot of research, and everybody can identify Visa, its logo, its colors, it's what you use it for in your daily life. But people think we're a bank. People think we were the ones who issued the credit. But, you know, there's still quite a bit of confusion about who we are. And by the way, you don't need to know what goes on under the bonnet. Right? You just need to know that your Visa credential, whether it's your card or your watch or your phone or online, works, is safe, is is going to be accepted. I imagine both Libby and Damien, when you came into the office this morning, you tapped into a tube or a train station, you bought a cup of coffee, maybe you picked up a newspaper, hopefully more than one, and you used some credential. Hope it was Visa, but whatever it was, you probably didn't pull cash out of your wallet. What happens when you tap that? I'm going to tell you. So you tap. Visa credentials are verified on your card. Visa systems do that. Visa confirms there's no fraud in the transaction and that there's not any fraudulent activity on your account. Visa verifies that you, the buyer, has sufficient funds in your bank to pay for whatever you're buying. We then send that transaction data to the seller's bank, in this case, the coffee shop or the news agent or the TFL. And that TFL's bank then sends the money to the seller and it's done. And you take your coffee or get on your tube or read your newspaper. All of that happens in 300 milliseconds. The blink of an eye. In fact, it took me probably 30 seconds to describe the process of the process. 10,000 times longer for me to explain it than for you to understand it. And we do that 65,000 times a second around the world and 700 million times a day. It's incredible.
Just thinking about the role of corporate communications and corporate affairs more broadly, How do you feel that role has changed and evolved during your career? I mean, we mentioned right at the top of the show your experience at City, where it seemed that that role really did evolve during your period there. And I'm sure it has elsewhere. But given your experience, how do you think the role has evolved, generally speaking?
I think it's a very different job today than when I started out. I mean, from very small things, like we didn't used to have internal employee communications teams. Like they were not an audience that we worked on. Usually HR would worry about that. But, you know, that's just a single example of how it's changed. Look, organizations all handle this a little bit differently. I'm sure you guys in doing these podcasts hear lots of different models for what a corporate affairs or a comms function looks like. And I've certainly been in a pretty wide range of them. But I think that we are almost always at the table now, which we didn't used to always be. I think we are viewed as strategic and commercial partners, which I'm not sure we always were. We did a lot more of that crisis management kind of work that you were alluding to. That was a bigger part of the job. It's still a huge part of the job, but businesses who are savvy and smart about this know that we can unlock a lot of commercial opportunity as well. So I think they're using us smarter. I did step away from comms for 4 years at Citi, as a lot of my peers have done. I think sometimes you get an itch where you think, I don't know, maybe I should try that other side of this business and give it a go. And, you know, maybe being client facing is, you know, an interesting thing to explore. And I should probably learn the business anyway. And I could go get an MBA, but I could just do that here. And I think a lot of my friends in comms have done the same. I had a great time. I loved it in many ways, but I love comms more. And I love comms with the, as we've discussed earlier, with the broader remit, with an executive who knows how to use you, with somebody who says, whoever's the best person to get the job done is the best person for the job. And if that's you, it could be way out of your remit. I mean, that's success, right? When you get asked to do something that is, you kind of think, oh, that's not really my job description. Well, that is because you are adding value. That is success. Those moments are terrific. I mean, you may have to juggle a lot of other things to find the space to get it done. But, those are great moments. And I don't think that used to happen early in my career.
In your opinion, what makes a great head of communications or corporate affairs?
It'd be a very long list because, as I was just saying, it takes a really wide range of to do the job really well. I think it takes a very wide range of skills. But if I had to prioritize, where would I even start? I think that judgment is, you know, first and foremost. You know, you've got it matters more than technical expertise. You know, good judgment, EQ, the ability to synthesize trends and moods and perspectives in a way that then you can interpret them back to your stakeholders and your teams. We used to call it, gut, like, oh, he's got a good gut instinct, or she's got strong instincts, or, you know, listen to her. She knows how to look at this. Now we have tools and data that help us do that. I still think I'd put gut instinct pretty high on a list, because this is art and science, right? The data isn't going to tell you what to do with it. You've got to have a good nose. Listening is really important. Curiosity, I think. I'm still new enough at Visa that I may just about be still in my honeymoon period to ask stupid questions. But what my team doesn't know is I never stop asking stupid questions. I think it often surprises you that a lot of people in the room don't know the same thing you're asking. And I think you just have to want to try to understand things really well. Creative problem solving, being able to spot good talent and getting good talent around you, and, you know, feeling passionate about developing people who are coming up behind you. I had a boss who said to me a long time ago, well, you don't get a leave until you've got a successor. So, you better get on that. I think that there's a lot of great comms talent. I think we as heads of function really need to be nurturing that very actively.
How do you manage upwards?
I think there's probably a couple rules of the road, maybe, and they're pretty obvious. I've always operated, and I learned this from a great mentor of mine, Michael Schlein, in City Hall, and then at the SEC, and then at Citi. I've worked with him for 20 years. No surprises. Boards don't like surprises. Executives don't like surprises. And so if you are in the room early and constantly, that's not really that hard to do. But you got to make sure you're at the table to avoid a surprise. I think that somebody once told me in a 360, an anonymous person, that they thought that I was the CEO's sparring partner. And I'm not sure they meant it as a compliment, but I took it as one.
Yeah.
I think your job is to prepare them for what's coming, to help them think better and more concisely and with more clarity and with more effective persuasion. So it maybe is a little like a warm-up
training partner.
Boxing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good one. The more you know them, the more time you spend with them, the more you know what keeps them up at night and worries them, and you understand their risk tolerance better. That at some point, and pretty quickly usually if you've got a good relationship, it becomes quite intuitive to you. And so I don't really think about it as managing up. I'm sure other guests here have said to you, you also have to be pretty brave and pretty tenacious. Sometimes you have to tell people things they don't want to hear. And sometimes you have to advise them against something they think is a great idea. If you can make something better, or even better, prevent a harmful action or decision that harms your reputation. But, you know, I've never had a boss who did not value that.
I think a lot of young people listening to that resume at the beginning of the show, of your career, will want to know, how do I go about getting a career like that? What's your advice to people who want to climb the greasy pole, as it were? How do you, looking back, and I suppose this is always with the benefit of hindsight, what have been some of the key things you're glad you did or glad you didn't do that helped you with that momentum and going from one thing to the next? Obviously, there's always a degree of luck, but there must be one or two other things that you can advise people.
First of all, the greasy pole analogy is a funny one because I, as you said, spent some time in Spain, and there's an annual festival. It's called La Tomatina. You've probably seen the videos on YouTube where this
crazy
little town outside of Valencia, like they all throw tomatoes at each other. It's brilliant. But what you might not know is the beginning of that festival has it's called, I think, the Palo Jamón, which means like the ham pole. And it is a greasy pole with a big, beautiful leg of jamón ibérico, the aged, beautiful Spanish ham, somehow latched to the top of it. And the tomatina can't start until somebody gets up the pole, gets the ham down, and throws it out to the crowd. And so it's this kind of annual ritual. I'm probably stretching this analogy, but the people who get the jamón down are almost always the people who rally the people around them to either build some sort of kind of human ladder, or who get people to give them their t-shirts and their towels to rub the grease off the pole. So again, it's a stretched analogy, but I mean, I think some combination of creativity and ingenuity combined with having amazing people around you to support you is the way you get up. It's a lot of graft, just a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And I know it's an unpopular thing to probably say, but put your hand up for projects. Ask your boss how they can help. If you've got a good idea, bring it. Don't bring a half-baked idea. Bring a good idea. I had a Wynne Bischoff, who was a great mentor of mine, told me a long time ago, don't ever bring your boss a problem without bringing a solution. And I think we've probably all gotten a little bit lazy about some of that. But I mean, I think if you really work hard, it will be recognized and, you know, you will differentiate yourself. And I think that that's really important.
And who has been the most important influence or mentor in your career?
Well, we could be here all day. I've had so many people help me along the way. It pains me to only pick a few. But the first person who took the biggest, earliest risk on me and giving me a job as his assistant in the mayor's press office was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and all-around amazing guy, Albert Scardino. Yes, we have the same surname because years later I married his brother. He has been a constant in my life and just, you know, an incredible, insightful, perceptive, very direct advisor. So I would put him first. Arthur Levitt, who was the chairman of the SEC, had been the economic policy advisor to the mayor. And I went with him to DC to work in the Securities and Exchange Commission, along with a few others of us. We were a little gang of people who moved down. We also were a gang that then moved to city. So to Andrew Walton's point, like, pick your people, because these were my people for 20 years. And Arthur was absolutely passionate about putting the individual investor at the center of the regulatory agenda for the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was a very kind of institutional regulator and an enforcement regulator. And so we did, and comms was central to that. We did a lot of investor education. We did a lot of lobbying on Capitol Hill to try to help us build, greater education at the time, because it was around the time that CNBC was becoming very popular and people were starting to get into the markets on their own. And there were a lot of, mutual fund opportunities that hadn't existed for a lot of people before. And so he really taught me what a kind of, before we called it purpose, before we called it, our mission, like, he had it. We didn't call it that, but, you knew exactly what you were there to do and how to support him to do it. Wim Bischoff, I've mentioned. I came out of government and into both the financial services and the private sector kind of space in London, which was not a city I'd ever lived in or knew, kind of off the turnip truck. And Wynn could not have been a more generous and gracious mentor who helped me understand how the city works, surprisingly savvy about, the way that the media worked, which was, my first remit there. We lost Wynn earlier this year, and I know he was a mentor to a lot of us. Anna Botin, we've already talked a lot about, absolutely incredible experience, an incredible leader and very gifted communicator.
And if you weren't in corporate affairs, what would your dream job be? If you had the freedom to choose any job in the whole world.
Oh my goodness.
For the rest of your life, what would you choose?
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing? I have had dream jobs. I am not spinning you. I'm unspinning. I have really had jobs that if I had looked at 30 years ago, I would have not believed it myself. I miss politics. I worry deeply, as I think probably all of us do, about the kind of state of civil discourse. I think it is urgent to certain organizations and certain institutions and certain politicians to use communications to get us back to a place of rationality. I am particularly anxious about some of the elections I mentioned earlier, particularly in the U.S. And is there a job somewhere that you can contribute to a return of sanity and moderation and, stop some of the extremism and hate that's going on in the world? I'd sign up for that job.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your company today and your really fascinating insights. You've been listening to Spin Unspun, the podcast from Instinctive Partners about corporate affairs and corporate communications with myself, Damien Rees, and my co-host today, Libby Wallace. Libby, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest today has been Jennifer Scardino, Head of Corporate Communications for Visa Europe. Join us again for our next episode of Spin Unspun. Details at instinctive.com. Find us on social media on the usual channels. And if you'd like to get in touch about Spin Unspun, just drop me a line, damien.rees@instinctive.com.